I'd like to apologize to everyone. During this particular recording, we had some Skype disconnections. So please bear with us. I'm going to try to edit them as best as we can. And where I noticed it, I'll let Patty know. And she hopefully picked up where she got cut off. But we hope you enjoy this episode. And yes, here it is. Hello, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu. And I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Pretty good, thanks. Can't complain. I noted that we have a new subscriber this week, so thank you very much. And for those of you who are not subscribed to us, please consider clicking the subscribe button down below. Click the bell so that you get notified when we release new content, typically every Friday evening. This past Friday, I did it at 6 instead of 7, so bonus hour. We have the various Facebook groups. All the links for those will be down below. And we have the email address where you can email your ideas, comments, just whatever you have for us. We'll be happy to hear from you. I know that was short and sweet, but now all the business end is taken care of. So, Patty, what do you have for us this evening?
Well, your wife had made a suggestion, and I thought it was an interesting one. So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the book. So for some of you who are newer, you may not know this, but I've been writing for about 27 years, and I have about 19 books that are paranormal in nature. And they cover all the topics from ghosts and hauntings to UFOs, Bigfoots, monsters, all kinds of things. And they cover several states. So I do some writing on North Carolina, West Virginia, and a lot on Pennsylvania, because that's my home state. And I wanted to share some of the stories. Some of these stories are really interesting. They're very poignant. And it's been a long time since they've been dusted off. So we're going to start with my very first book, which was called Haunted Pennsylvania. For those who see it, that's what it looked like.
Since you put that up there, I don't have to put the still frame, because out of all of your books that are sitting on my shelf right now, I actually recorded a video separately. I picked up one, held it in front of me, put it down, picked up another. So anytime you talk about one of your books, I could, if it's one of the ones that I have in my own personal library, I could actually put the still image up of me holding it with my smiling countenance there. So, but I liked it when you did it.
Oh, okay.
That made it even all the more special.
Well, this was my very first book, and a little backstory to it. Of all the books, this is the most intimate one. Now, every book has some really cool stories, and many of the older books have some family type stuff. But this particular book, there's an awful lot of it. In fact, what happened was, I've always loved writing. I was writing for local newspapers, and I was pregnant with my middle child and decided to spend the entire winter locked in the house, because it was the middle of one of the iciest winters we've ever had. And so I was like, I'll just sit and write. And I had always wanted to write my first collection of ghost stories, and so I decided to put down all the family stories first, and all the stories that I had heard growing up. Now, my grandma was a great storyteller, so she was my biggest inspiration. So that's what I sat down to do. I sent the book out to the first publisher. They came back and said, it's a great book, but we're not doing any short story collections. Take this letter, attach it to the book, and send it to other publishers. Let them know that you're not being rejected because it's not a good book, but rather because we just aren't able to do short story collections. It's not in their setup for that year. So the second publisher I sent it to contacted me and told me she wanted this really good selling, long-term, slow book. And then Haunted Pennsylvania came out, and it went crazy. Like, we published it, and I think within 3 weeks, 5,000 copies were sold regionally. That's a lot of books in a rural area. And then it just sort of ballooned from there. The last I heard, we have somewhere near 30,000 copies that were sold. So that's a lot of books, and that's a couple years ago. I have no clue. So the book is now currently out of print, but you can get used copies if you would like. And I wanted to share a couple of stories, because these are stories that I had loved for years and came from different people. So the first one I wanted to tell you was a story called Little Boy Lost. So I lived in an area called Gannister. It's rural. It's out in the woods, and it sits this little village. It's actually like three little villages, and that was where the Piney Creek and the Juniata River meet. So there's a little section of the village on one side of the river. There's a little section of the village on the other side of the river. Then you go across a bridge, and there's a third little section that all makes up the area called Gannister. And Gannister has a historical significance because there's something called Gannister Quarry Rock that is mined, was mined there. And it's a very, very hard rock, and it was used a lot during the years of World War II. So it was a very, very popular place. It was very lucrative to work there, and a lot of the people who came were immigrants. Up on the mountainside, there sat a house. When I was a little girl, it was just this old abandoned house, and my dad used to tell us the story, and I'm going to tell you the story tonight. So there was a little farm homestead type thing sat up on the side of the mountain, and you could see it because it was still meadows and stuff up there, and so you could see it sitting there at the edge of the woods. And this is the story of why the house became abandoned. And to this day, nobody has an answer. So we're looking at the late 1700s into maybe 1800. And the family was living in the house. The little boy's, one of his jobs was to feed the chickens at night and in the morning, just to give them, you know, a little grain, whatever they had. So he was told to do it, and he didn't do it this particular night. And his dad asked him at the table if all his chores were done, and he said no, that he didn't feed the chickens. And he said, why? And he told him because he was afraid of the shadow. And his dad, you know, didn't believe him, didn't buy the story at all. And so he said to him, you're going to go out and you're going to feed those chickens. So the little boy did. He kind of hemmed and hawed and tried his best to not go, but he ended up having to. So he took an old granite basin and he filled it up with some scratch and went out to the chicken coop. His dad could hear him. He couldn't see him because the way the chicken coop was built, it faced the water and not the house. But he could hear the door slam. You could hear the grain hitting the granite basin. It was very obvious sound. And then the door slam again as he went into the chicken coop section to feed the chickens. And then all of a sudden, there's a pause, complete silence, and then scream. The door slams, and the scream continues until it's cut off a few seconds later. His dad jumps up, runs out, and the door to the chicken coop's hanging open. The little boy's not there. He has no clue what's going on. And, you know, this is a time frame where they're could have been a lot of solutions. It could have been, there were Native Americans still in the region, so that could have been a possibility. There were people that were like bandits and gypsies that were still in the region. In fact, less than a quarter mile from there, there's a place that's to this day is called Gypsy Road because gypsies would travel it so much. That's a possibility. Wild animals was a possibility. There were just a lot of possibilities, paranormal ones not being the first one that probably came to mind in that time frame. So his dad's looking for his son. It's beginning to get dusky, and he finds there's a little tiny island of ground in the creek that's dry whenever the water goes low. And it's there that he finds the granite basin and some broken branches as though something had gone through. And they never found this little boy, ever. And that was a mystery. And I remember looking at it. And then I found the 411 books years and years and years later. And I started to read them. And I flashed back to that story my dad used to tell. Because the family eventually gave up. You know, they had a lot of people came out and helped them for at least a week or two. Try to find them. They combed the woods. The word spread around. Nothing, absolutely nothing was ever found. No shoes, no clothes, no bones, no anything. It was just like he just vanished. And I don't know if it's a paranormal story or not, but it certainly kept me up many nights as we sat at the bottom of that mountain and I could see from my bedroom the ruins of that old abandoned cabin. So that's one of the first stories. And like I said, that's a story I grew up with. And the next story I kind of got from a boyfriend when I was a teenager. So I dated a boy from our church who came from a different branch of our church over in Huntington County. And this is his story, his family story. So his mother was a very active person in their local church, but she didn't drive a car. When his dad died, that kind of made it difficult for her to get to church and, you know, do stuff because dad used to take her. So she had a good friend who began to come and pick her up. They were both older ladies in their like 60s, and they literally lived in a shanty. It was a little bit of a shanty, and there was a little horseshoe driveway that went around the shanty back out onto this little dirt road back in the woods where they lived. And it was that way even when I knew them. And according to the story that his mother told and that he vowed was true, and so did other people that knew him very well, it would have been the early 1970s, one evening, Sunday evening, about 5:30, 6 o'clock, this lady that was his mom's friend was supposed to come and pick her up for church, and she didn't come. And that was very unlike her. She would have either come or called if she was ill. So his mom calls up to the house and asks, you know, if she's okay. Nobody answers. Eventually, it gets really late. Still, nobody's answering. So she finally calls this woman's daughter and says, I don't know what to make of this. This isn't like your mom. And they go out looking, thinking maybe she broke down along the road. Maybe she fell at the house. So all night long, her family's looking for her. Come morning, first thing, the gentleman I was dating at the time, right across the road from them was like this little hill and then a little trail that would go back into the woods to the creek, and local people would pull back in there and wash their cars. It was just something that everybody locally knew to do. So he was out looking around, you know, because everybody's kind of restless now. They're worried about her. She's just disappeared. And it's like 6:30 in the morning, kind of foggy and misty out by the creek, but he decides to take a walk down that way, and he notices it looks like somebody had recently driven in. The weeds are all pressed down as though a car had passed over it. So he decides to walk down there, and as he turns the curve behind that little hillock, he sees her car hanging open. And the driver's door is open, and there's a shoe laying there. Well, he runs back to the house, and he calls, you know, tells his mom, call the police. Her car's back here. Something happened to her. Oh, my gosh. Something happened to her. And they begin looking in the area, you know, and the police are up and down the road. They start talking about she must have been abducted, all this stuff going on. So she's not found. There's no clues. About a week, week and a half go by. And one night, the gentleman I dated and his older brother were talking, and they remembered that up the hill behind their house, over the top of one of the little hillocks, there was a little valley, and in that little valley was an old abandoned house that had been there forever, and nobody had been up in there. I mean, the trail up to it had been completely overgrown. You couldn't even tell there had ever been a driveway back there. And they get the idea that, you know, I wonder if anybody's checked back there. So they decide to walk up, and it's kind of cold and miserable, and they walk up, and they find her remains inside this little abandoned house, and it's obvious that she had been assaulted before she had died. And so, of course, they run down, they call the police come, the whole nine yards. So it's just a sad story until about a month or two later, one of their family friends and his wife get in a really bad argument. So he decides to spend the night at this family's home. Now, like I said, it's a small ramshackly place. There's no spot for him to sleep or anything. So he asks if they care if he just pulls his truck up in the driveway and he'll sleep in his truck for the night, and hopefully by morning everything will have blown over. In the middle of the night, he's hitting his horn and he's screaming, and they get out of bed and they go out, and he's hysterical. He swore up and down that he's sitting in the truck, very uncomfortable, trying to doze, can't go to sleep. It's like 2 in the morning. And he heard a on the window, and he looked up expecting it to be one of the boys, and instead it was that lady. He knew her well. She was standing there in her blue coat, and she was tapping on the window to get his attention. And he freaked out and, you know, kind of shot back across the bench seat. And she just stood there for quite a few seconds looking at him and tapping the window. And then when, as if it dawned on her, he wasn't going to pull that window down for her to get in or to reach him or talk to him, she faded away. Well, you know, they accused him of the nightmares and what have you. And that was that until about a year and a half later, they Phil had a friend who had two little children, and she was getting her kids into the car really late one night after visiting the family. And she put the first little girl in the car and snapped the seatbelts and went around to the other side to put the little other little one in the car. And as she backed up, she backed into somebody, turned around expecting it to be one of the boys or his mom, you know, and that she might have forgotten something. And in that moment, she turns around, she comes face to face with the same woman. And she's looking and her mouth is going, but there's no sound coming out. And the woman just freaks out. She slams the car door, runs around the other side, gets into the car, goes to the edge of the driveway and starts honking the horn for somebody to come out of the house. And they come out and she tells them this crazy story. Over the years, they had had multiple people visit them who had in some fashion seen this woman. Not only that, but people would drive by and talk about seeing this woman wandering along the road wearing an older lady wearing a blue coat. And it was one of those quilted coats that ladies used to wear in the 60s and early 70s. You know what I'm talking about with the big, big buttons?
I do, yeah. And kind of like, you know, squarish kind of puffy pattern. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And she was missing a shoe. And so people thought she was in distress. And sometimes they'd stop to ask her for help, or they would go the 2 miles into town, find the policeman and tell him there's a lady out there. I don't know what's going on, but I think something's wrong with her. And she's right out there, and they would give the directions, and it would always be right in front of their house. She haunted for quite a long time. Now, I don't know if she's been seen in recent years, but as of 20 years ago, she was still haunting the property and was seen from time to time. And, you know, it was just a really sad kind of story because nobody has ever found out what she wanted to tell them. But she made many attempts.
Yeah, especially since they couldn't hear her. But that, you know, whenever you mention that, I'm thinking to myself, and we did this before, about ghosts who tried to solve their own murders, you know. Was she trying to say what happened to her? You know, that's a
possibility. She might very well have known the person. The best the police could ever come up with is that she must have pulled in the far end of the driveway to swing up around that circle, because she would always pull up close to the steps because my friend's mom was she was crippled, and it was hard for her to get up and down the steps and, you know, walk very far. And so she would pull up as close to the steps as she could get, so it wasn't as much of a walk for this woman. And as she pulled in, either somebody jumped out of the bushes, stopped her, like they needed some assistance, something along that line. And she must not have had any fear of them, because she obviously stopped. Then they got into her car, forced her to drive around to the other side, or forced her to pull the car off the road, at least, and then drove her up through the woods, came back after they tied her up, and pulled the car over there out of sight, and then went back and finished her.
Either way, something bad happened.
Yes, and as stories go, it was fascinating to me as a young adult, because this is a story that, you know, I could put my hands on the fact that this woman existed. Her friends are telling me this story, and people are coming in over and over. I knew these people for years, saying, yeah, this happened to me, this happened to me, and it's the same thing. She's there, she's looking like she's trying to get some information across urgently, but she can never make a sound other than the tapping. She made the tapping sound. So, you know, that's one of my very first ghost stories. I think that I'll tell you the story of London Bridge. This is probably one of my favorite stories. And this story came to me because I knew the person it happened to, and I was there like right after it happened, like hours after it had happened. So my mom worked for a detention facility for teenagers. And it was built on a property where there was this old mansion. And it was out in the woods in the middle of nowhere. And it was kind of there by design. The gentleman who owned it, the property, wanted to help kids that were drug addicts and in trouble and what have you. So he wanted to build something. He already owned this property, but it was also a hard place to run away from because city kids are afraid to run away into the woods. It's, you know, they're out of their element. So he found it was a great help with keeping them put because they were 15 miles from the nearest town. So where they might have run away and gone into a town right away, they had no clue how to get there. And, you know, so it made a big deal. So anyhow, because of this, he had several employees who lived on the property in small houses. My mom's friend, Nancy, was the very first person hired for this particular facility. And she had one of the cabins and she lived there. She was a recovering addict and an alcoholic. And she would go to AA meetings with a local priest named Father Tim. And one of her jobs, because she did live on the property and she lived right behind the mansion house, which was being renovated to be turned into office space and what have you, in private quarters for the guy who owned the property on the second floor for when he was in the area. She was to keep an eye on that big mansion house, beautiful gray stone mansion. So one night she's coming back from the AA meeting with her friend, who was the priest, who would drive down and pick her up. She didn't have a car. And she noticed a light in the attic window. And she said to him, "Somebody's broke into the mansion house. I got to go check it out." And he's like, "Well, no, you can't do that by yourself. You know, we're out in the middle of nowhere." But at that point, she was the only employee there. They hadn't finished renovating and opening the building. And he was very concerned about her going into that building alone at night. And so he said, "It could be a hobo or a vagrant who doesn't realize the property's being used again. Give me a flashlight and I'll go upstairs and check." And this was in the attic. So she gives him the flashlight. And she can follow his progress by the light moving, you know, through the building. And as she's sitting or standing there on the ground right outside watching in case he needs help, the attic windows, there were the dormer windows that open up on hinges, open up right above her head. And she hears a little girl singing "London Bridge is Falling Down." And she said, "I got the heebie-jeebies like you can't imagine." And she sees the flashlight going up, and there was this flickering light, remember, up there. It looked like a candle, maybe. And she yelled, "Tim, is there a child up there with you?" And not a sound. As soon as she spoke, the sound of the little girl singing "London Bridges" went away. And then you heard this priest running down the stairs, and he kind of runs outside to her, and he's like, come on. So they go up to her cabin and go inside the cabin. He locks the door. He's very agitated. Finally, he calms down and he says to her, "Did you hear it?" And she's like, "The little girl singing? Yes, I heard it. Wish there were a little child up there. Do we have to call somebody? What's going on?" And he's like, "Oh, she's well beyond being called, getting help for her." And this is what he said he saw. He said he saw the shadow of a little girl sitting on the floor, leaning against the dormer window that was open. He saw it open. And she was holding a doll in her arms like a baby and rocking it and singing "London Bridges" to it. Now, that's just creepy. I don't care who you are. And, you know, the priest was rattled. Everybody was rattled. Fast forward 3 years. Now the facility's running at full tilt. The whole place has been renovated, and one summer a gentleman shows up there and he explains to the staff that his great grandfather had owned that property and that he would like to tour the house, the main house, which is now office space, because his mother had told him stories about it as a child growing up, and he always hoped that if he ever got to Pennsylvania, he could see this house. And he had traveled there from Florida for business or something, and he had decided to make the journey out to see this house. So they were gracious about it, and they said, sure, not a problem. And he kept insisting he wanted to see the attic. And they were like, well, that's kind of not the part of the house I would have expected. And he's like, I really just want to see the attic, please. So my mother and Nancy and another staff person took this man through the house and up to the attic, and he went over to the dormer window, and he was touching it with reverence, you know, as though this meant something to him. And he turned and he said to them, has anybody ever heard of the little girl? And, you know, my mother and Nancy were best friends, and Nancy's like, what little girl? And he's like, the little girl. And he said, look, let's go downstairs where you'll be comfortable, and I'll tell you what happened. I think I know who the little girl is. So basically the story was, in the 1920s, this little girl's parents were the grandparents of this little girl owned the house. Her parents died in a car accident. She was about 9 years old. She came to live with her grandparents, and the staff there was like a housekeeper and a maid that kind of helped with the housework, because the couple were older, and they loved this little girl, and her grandma doted on her. I mean, she had lost her only child, her son, and so having this little child of his was a gift, but not for the husband. The grandfather didn't like her. She was noisy. She was messy. She disrupted his peace and quiet. And he was constantly sending her up to her room. And eventually it got to the point where he made them move her stuff to the attic bedroom, the room with the dormer windows. And she was banished there more than she wasn't. And she'd have to take her meals up there alone, and she would cry. She wasn't allowed any toys. But the servants had snuck up a baby doll, her favorite baby doll, and had her grandmother had sewn a pocket in the underside of the duvet that hung over the side of the bed to hide the baby in so he wouldn't see it. And when she thought she was going to be observed, she would open the windows and sing London Bridges and rock her baby to try to kind of comfort herself. And obviously her grandma knew this wasn't good for her. So her grandma had begun writing relatives and asking if any of them that had children would take her. And one of the cousins did take her. And it was this man's grandmother, her family, that had taken this little girl. And she had died of a childhood illness about 9 months after leaving. And it was after that that the grandmother contacted them and told them that they had heard the little girl upstairs singing in the attic, and that some of the servants said they had seen her up there. And he said, I think she's still here. My mother was completely convinced. And that's the reason I wanted to come here. I wanted to come and I wanted to tell her it's okay to leave. And it had stuck with him. I mean, his mother obviously had made this very poignant. So he went back upstairs with my mom and Nancy and this other lady. They kind of had a conversation. Nobody heard anything. And Nancy said, I don't think she was willing to leave, because she's like, I heard her singing on other nights. Nancy's cabin was literally a few hundred yards from this area. So if she had her windows open at night, she could hear it. And she lived there for probably 5 or 6 years, and she continued to hear this little girl from time to time singing. But after that, it wasn't happening anymore, because now you knew her story, and that she was lonely, and that she was comforting herself the best she knew how. But I can remember standing outside Nancy's little cottage, looking up at that window and wondering, as about a 14 or 15 year old kid.
And at that time, had you already had paranormal experiences yourself, right?
I had had a couple. Like, my grandfather, I told the story about when my grandfather passed away, and I saw him at the foot of the bed. And so I had had a couple experiences, but I never got to go into the attic or anything like that. I've only been in the house briefly, maybe 2 or 3 times in my entire life. Although I will tell you, after the first book came out, staff at the building have contacted me for 35 years. I'm not lying. It's got to be 30 years. Telling us that she's still hurt up there.
I'm surprised they didn't contact you to help her cross over.
Well, I think the building's passed hands several times, but I've had staff and former staff reach out to me and tell me their experiences of hearing her or seeing her or what have you over the course of that period of time. So it was an interesting story. And that place had a lot of really weird stuff, like another story that's in the book. And I'll tell this one real quick. And this is one of my, it's a fascinating story. It's kind of creepy, but it's also fascinating. So the main building was built for the detention center. So it was built with a great big open rec room, a great big open kitchen, a great big open like dining area where you could also have classes and stuff, you know, so that, because the kids had to go to school there. They couldn't leave the facility for anything. There was a built-in swimming pool and other rec buildings and stuff outside it. And then the mansion sat at the very top of this hill overlooking the whole complex. It was very pretty. It was like a campus, if you would. And Nancy, she had a very odd upbringing. Her stepmother was a witch. So she had brought her up as a Wiccan. And Nancy didn't always get socially appropriate stuff, like you shouldn't do certain things with kids. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And she was nice. I really liked her. She was a very nice lady. But one night she called my mom and she was hysterical and she was screaming that Lafayette was in the building. And my mom was like, "What are you talking about?" And she's like, "Peggy, you gotta hurry, you gotta hurry." Just to the story. So it's Saturday night. Saturday night was pizza night. So a group of the kids would go into the kitchen with one of the two house parents and make pizza. There was a gentleman house parent who was helping with the pizza on that night. The other group was in the rec room and they were wanting to do something spooky. So she got a Ouija board from her house and brought it down. And they were messing with the Ouija board. And the planchet began to really work well, really well. And it was shooting across the board and spelling out the name of this guy. And his name was Lafayette. And he was a black man. And he supposedly had an earring in his left ear. And he was a pirate from New Orleans. And telling this insane story, right? And his name was Jean Lafayette. And she asked him what he wanted. And he said, "To kill you." Well, like the kids are like freaking out. And they're screaming, "Oh my gosh, no." And finally, she's like, "Okay, enough of that. We stop that." And she realizes that she's probably psyched these kids out way too much. So she decides to like pack the board up and get them watching a movie and, you know, try to change the topic. And just as she's finishing this process and she's finally calming them down, she hears screaming out of the kitchen. So part of the kitchen work crew that night was two teenage boys. They were hysterical. They were in the other part of the house. So they didn't hear the story, right? Mm-hmm. And they went to the pantry, the walk-in pantry, to get these big cans of tomato sauce because they're making, you know, enough pizza to feed 40 people. And they swore in that pantry stood a black man who looked like a pirate with an earring in his ear and long black curls. And he was holding a cutlass or something. And when they came in, he yelled and vanished, and it freaked them out. And that's what they were yelling and screaming. The guy went in and he said he didn't see anything. And just as he was leaving the pantry, the one girl in front that was standing there, it's like, you know, all the kids are kind of like this now, like what's going on? And the boys are still about half hysterical. She screams, "Look behind you, look behind you." And he turns and he sees this figure moving and rippling, and then it's gone. So now he's like, "I don't know what the hell's going on. I'm totally done with this." And he makes all the kids come out of the kitchen area to the area where Nancy's at. And Nancy's eyes are as big as saucers because she knows she's responsible for this whole thing. So they get the kids all to watching a movie. They make the pizza. They get through the evening and they put the kids to bed. And that should be the story, but it's not. So the building was built so that the kids can't escape. Again, that's important. So they have all flush stone walls. You can't climb up and down it. It was literally like concrete block. and the windows are shut. You can open them to get a little fresh air, but they only opened a small amount, and the building had AC and stuff, so it wasn't like you couldn't stay cool. But because obviously kids could shinny out a window and take a sheet and drop to the ground, and so they had these precautions. And there was nothing for the kids to stand on. So they put the girls to bed, and then as they're working their way down the girls' section, so the girls' section's on one side, there's a central area where the house parents would sit at night, and then on the other side was the boys' section. And they get through with the girls, and the male house parent is just about done with the boys when all of a sudden all hell breaks loose at the far end of the girls' section, and the girls are screaming. And they come flying out, and they're like, "There was a girl! There was a girl! It's the girl from the mansion!" Because their context for a ghost would be, of a child, would be the only ghost on the property, and everybody knew the ghost story, was the little girl that sang London Bridges. And they kept saying she was hanging on to the window and looking in at them, almost like a vampire movie. I mean, it was that kind of creepy. And the girls were terrified. So they wouldn't go in the room again without both house parents, and like they were looking around and like, "We're not going to sleep in this room. We don't want to sleep in this room." So they ended up going downstairs to sleep in the dining area because there were some couches there. And just about that time on the boys' section, it freaks them out and they're screaming that there's this little girl in a nightgown staring in the window at them. So they go running over there and they, you know, they check this out, and the boys are hysterical. So that's when Nancy calls my mother at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And she wants my mother to come out because all the kids are now in the rec room, in their pajamas, scared to death to go to sleep. And Nancy's frankly lost control. So my mom comes out, and the minute she said, the minute she walked, I remember being out there that night because I remember we had to go sit in the one other section of the building by ourselves. Till she was done. And I remember her, she walked through the door, she said, "Oh my God, Nancy, what have you done?" Like the energy was just insane in that building. And she said to us, "You know, you go over there and sit on those chairs and don't move." And we're half asleep. She rousted us out of bed to take us with her because we were kids. And she went upstairs and it seemed like she was gone forever, but probably 40 minutes to an hour. And she was up there praying and working with the kids and making the kids come upstairs and getting them to bed, calming them down. It took 2 weeks before whatever it was that was clinging on those walls outside quit clinging on the walls. And the guy, Jean Lafitte, he was seen for about a week and a half. Even by staff who hadn't been there, who heard nothing about it, but went into the kitchens to do cooking and stuff. Had encounters with seeing this guy run into the pantry and disappear. And I honestly don't know. It just seemed to stop after a while. My mom would go down there all the time and pray and what have you. And eventually she got it to go away. So those were some of the stories I heard growing up. Mm-hmm. Very odd and creepy. And those are family stories because, you know, those were stories that literally happened to us as kids, you know, growing up, or these are stories that our families told and what have you. So I'm going to tell one last story, and it's about the gray house. So it's actually one of my brother's stories, one of my brothers who passed away this past year. His name was Jerry, and he rented this or bought this little gray house in town on our main street. It was just a little, like it was three little rooms downstairs, a living room and a kitchen, and I guess it was like a little storage room. It wasn't even big enough to be a dining room. And then there was a set of stairs, and you would go upstairs, and there was three small bedrooms upstairs. Nothing to write home about, but it was a starter house for him and his family. They had a little boy at the time, and she was pregnant for the second time. So he buys this house, and it was an article of agreement. People who aren't familiar, it's when you rent to own. They don't do that much anymore, but they were popular at one point. And the house was in really nice shape from what I remember. There was a curtain that separated the living room and the kitchen. And that's kind of important. So they would, he rented the house or bought the house, and he was doing a little bit of repairs to the house as he could afford to. And just trying to, you know, keep the house going. Because, you know, a house you rent to own usually needs some fixing. And he was pretty good with his hands. He was a mechanic and could do woodworking and stuff like that. So he was just like chucking away at it. And then he started talking to my dad about the fact that the front door wouldn't stay locked. Like, it didn't matter if they locked it before bed, they'd get up in the morning, it was wide open. They'd go to work, he'd be the last one, he'd make sure it was locked, he'd come home, or a neighbor would call him at work and say, hey, are you aware your front door's hanging wide open? And he's like, no. And he'd come home at lunch break and shut the door and lock it. And then he noticed that the window on the staircase, you know how staircases have like four or five steps and then they turn and they have another. So on that little landing, there was a window and it would open itself up. And he would come home and he would shut the window. He would lock the house and he would go back to work and he would come back at the end of the day and it would be open again. And it just never seemed to work. So my dad said, well, maybe it's not plumb. Maybe the latches aren't latching all the way. So they rehung the door. They went to all this trouble, reframed everything, and it seemed to work really good, except that a couple days later, the door's hanging open. Window's up again. This kept going on, and then one night, it was probably 8 o'clock at night, our phone rings, and my brother's on the phone. He's almost hysterical, and he's yelling, Dad, Dad, you guys got to come in town. Here in town, you got to hurry up. There's shit going on in this house. Like, he was hysterical. So my dad and mom pack us up and take us in town, and my dad was the least paranormal person I knew. Like, I never heard him tell a ghost story or anything the entirety of my life. And he goes into the house, and there's this great big ceramic ashtray that my oldest brother had made as a gift because they were all smokers back then, and was sitting on a coffee table. And as my dad walked in, the ashtray picked itself up and slammed itself into the wall right by his head, which kind of was interesting. And that got everybody's attention.
I was going to say, that's a big time attention getter.
Yeah, literally. Like, they literally walked through the doorway and smash as though somebody threw it. At that point, that curtain between the living room and the kitchen began to blow, and my dad went running through it thinking there was going to be windows open on the other side, and there were not. And it just, it was like it was picking up like a vortex. It was activity. And then the pictures started to rattle. I was there. I was about 8, but I can remember watching those pictures in awe, not knowing how to make sense of it, but I was seeing them literally swaying on the wall, going back and forth as the wind was hitting them. And it was like you were in the middle of a hurricane. It was that very strong wind. The pillows fell off the couch, you know, that kind of thing. And at that point, the hall that set up that window in the hallway, you know, going up the steps, slammed itself up open. And my dad ran over, slammed it down, ratcheted the latch down. And as he's standing there going, well, that's that, it opened itself again and slammed itself up behind him. And then the front door opened and started to slam itself back and forth. And at that point, my dad's like, just get the kids and get everybody out of here now. So we all went outside. We're in the backyard. We're kind of watching the house, and you can see the curtains are moving. You can see the windows up. You can see the doors opening and closing. It's just insane. And my dad told him, he's like, I don't know what the hell's going on in that house. I don't know, but you just need to get out of there and get out of there now. So within a week, my brother had somehow managed to get past the article of agreement, and the people didn't give him too much trouble, which was interesting. Now that I'm an adult, when I was a kid, it was just like, thank goodness we never have to go back there, you know? The house gets sold years later to a aunt of my oldest brother's wife. And when they're renovating the house, they found that wrapped in an oil cloth under the one corner of the house was a body. Probably murder. I mean, by this point, it had been there for many, many years. It was not a whole lot you could see. And it totally changed everything. The house actually got torn down. And today there's another house sitting on the property, but it sits on the far side, as far away from that area. That's now yard. And I have to tell you, it was my very first paranormal experience beyond my grandfather coming to say goodbye. And it was just so bewildering to see those pictures moving and understand that there was a windstorm happening inside this house. And, you know, like I said, it was years and years until we understood why it was haunted. Because that was like a good 10, 15 years later that these people bought it and decided to put a basement under it and remodel it. And during that period is when they found the remains of this woman. But I have to tell you, that's probably one of the reasons I've always been fascinated with the paranormal is I wanted to understand. I wanted to know. And I've seen a lot of really strange things over the years since then. But I will tell you, I still can hearken back to that and the inability to make sense out of it as a child. And I get it when people tell me they froze, they didn't know what to do, they couldn't quite comprehend what was happening, because I've been there. With that, I will call it the end of our stories for tonight. I hope folks enjoyed stories from the original Haunted Pennsylvania. And on another evening, maybe we'll visit some of the other books.
I think my favorite story out of that particular book is the one with the devil on the pump.
Well, would you like to hear it one before we go? That was my grandmother's story.
If, you know, if we leave that with that, maybe that will cause some people to go and to go and try to find that book. But yeah, I would really like to hear that story.
Well, I'm happy to share it again. So this is a story I grew up hearing. This was a story that happened to my grandmother when she was about 14 years old. She lived in a place called Acosta in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. And my family's always been Pentecostal Church of God. And she was on her way back from a revival. Her older sister, Mary, and about a odd dozen other teenagers. So today people get online and they play video games and stuff like that, but there wasn't a whole lot to do in Acosta in the 1940s. So when a revival came to town, you went. You got dressed up, you listened to the preacher, you saw all the people, you looked at all the cute boys, if you're 14 years old, and you know, then you go home. So this group of teenagers had gotten permission to go to the revival. And it was an old-fashioned hellfire and brimstone revival. You know, the minister with his face red and his neck bulging, screaming, "Repent! Rest!" You know, that kind of thing. And I'm not making fun, because I've lived through many, many of the hellfire and brimstone sermon. But my grandma said that during the sermon, as they were finishing up and doing the altar call and people were coming up, she said, the minister would lay his hands on the forehead of a person, and when he would touch them, they would collapse. And she said, sometimes you would see this thing come out of their body and was running through the pews looking for somebody else to dive into. She took it to be a demon, which most likely is what it was, okay? And so she was really rattled by this. And my grandma was really sensitive. She didn't know that at the age of 14. So they're going home now, revival's over. My grandma's kind of quiet and pensive, and so is one of the other girls. So my Aunt Mary is a little more gregarious than my grandma, Helen. And she's like, "Helen, hurry up, you know, come on, what's wrong with you?" And grandma said, "Mary, did you see the demons, you know, running through the pews?" And you know, my Aunt Mary laughed at her and said, "Oh, that's ridiculous." And the other little girl who was quiet said, "Oh, Helen, did you see them too?" As though she were relieved that someone else had seen them. And so, you know, they were talking, and there was a boy who was about 15 or 16. He was very full of bravado, and he thought he was better than all of them because he was richer and he was older, and, you know, and he starts huffing about, "Oh, you girls are imagining things. I won't believe in a demon unless he shows right up in front of me. That's ridiculous. It's hogwash." So they get to my Aunt Mary and my Grandma Helen's house, and they invite them in for tea, a way to socialize a little longer. And back then, they would get their water from a pump in the backyard. And when they came in, they realized that the bucket was empty and that they needed water. So Grandma said, "Well, I have to go out to get water." And she said it kind of hesitantly because she was afraid from what she had seen that night, you know. She was still a little spooked. She's 14. I think I'd have been spooked too. And the teenage boy, the older boy, said, "Oh, just give me the bucket, Helen. I'll go get it." And he went stomping off to the pump. A few seconds later, they hear the bucket clatter. They hear the boy scream. And they go running out, all the teenagers. And there stands the boy with the bucket on the ground. And between him and the group of teenagers is the pump, and leaning against the pump, which was this great big old pitcher pump that had, it was like 4 foot high, was this bent handle. And leaning against that bent handle was this little green being. And he looked at this teenage boy who had been doubting Thomas, and he said, "I am real. Believe." Real slow like that. And the boy yelled, it's a trick. And he reached to grab out. And at that point, this green being, whatever it was, blinked out, and he caught hold of the pump handle and burned his hand because it was hot, completely hot to the touch. And that obviously ended the evening. And my grandmother was completely convinced that his doubt had fueled this being's desire to scare them further. And so it had followed them home. And that is the demon on the pump. And my grandma used to tell that when I was a little girl, and I would sit at her feet. And I can still see her old-fashioned house slippers and hear her voice as she told it. And she told it with great conviction. And I will tell you this, her older sister Mary, who was there that night as well, always, when I'd ask her about it, would tell me, "Oh, Patty, I don't want to talk about that, but you know, what Helen said happened really did." So the two people that were eyewitnesses both corroborated each other throughout the years.
When my son was still in school, and he's 30, that's pretty bad. I don't remember how old my son was, or son is right now, 33. For one particular Halloween, we took him and his friend to the Royer Mansion for their Halloween celebration. And they actually reenacted, or they told the story of that next to the pump that's in the kitchen.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if you know they did that, but that was and I had read your book by that time, because you know the one that I have, I did have to find it used, so I felt bad about buying that because you don't make any money off a used book.
All right.
But that was one of my favorite stories in there.
And, it was one of my favorite stories growing up, I mm-hmm. can tell you. I would, like, when she would start telling stories, and I would always say to her, Grandma, tell us the demon on the pump, tell us the demon on the pump. And my kids loved it. In fact, at Royer, on a different year, the GRF, the Ghost Research Foundation, and my kids would always volunteer. We would raise money for the Royer House every year, several thousand dollars we would be able to raise in a night to help with renovations and stuff for the house. And my middle boy, Michael, practiced that story every day for a month or two because he was going to tell it. Mm-hmm. And to this day, he still tells the story pretty well, tells it to his own children. But yeah, that was one of my very first ghost stories. I was like a little girl, 7 years old, whenever I first heard that.
Well, I really appreciate you relaying that. Now I'm satisfied.
Well, I hope that our listeners have all enjoyed themselves. If you want to hear more, you know, of my old-fashioned local ghost stories and what have you, I'd be happy to share them with you down the pike. I've got some other things coming up for the next 2 or 3 weeks, but never hurts. Like for me, this is like going home and visiting. I can hear my grandma's voice. I can still see the sights and smell the sounds of scents and, you know, everything. So I enjoy these reminiscences. So I hope everybody enjoyed them as well.
Hey, thanks. Good night, Patty.
Good night.